Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Augmented World Expo 2026, and also digging into the topic of open and interoperable ideas that give me a lot of hope for the future of XR. So today's interview is with Neil Trevitt of the Kronos Group, and he's talking about the Open Browser Metaverse Initiative. And so I covered a lot of the preliminary ideas in the previous conversation with Sean Mann, where they basically wanted to be able to have you walk around and then have more of an open, interoperable way for pulling in lots of different dynamic information from different services at the same time and be able to composite it into the same scene. This was something that I first saw Pluto VR do, and it kind of blew my mind just because you think about like opening different browser tabs, but those browser tabs have different independent 2D contexts that aren't necessarily interacting with each other. But with XR and spatial computing, when you're combining different services together, you're essentially taking different contexts and kind of mashing them together into the same spatial context. So as a metaphor, you think about like Spotify would be like maybe a radio that is there and it's embedded into a space. But there may be a TV that's over there that's also pulling in different video channels. And so you can imagine having both a radio and a TV in the same space, and it's kind of occupying these different services that are going to be melded together. That's kind of like the idea of what's happening with the Open Browser Initiative, which is trying to get out of the mindset of apps and have a open standard way of pulling in different information and dynamically have these different services at the same time. And so I go into a lot of the core concepts with Sean Mann in the previous interview, but in this conversation with Neil, we take a step back and really start to think about the metaverse broadly in terms of all the different standards that are building up and creating this equivalent of what we've seen with the internet and the World Wide Web, with all these open standards that have created this amazing repository of shared human endeavor of all these different experiences, applications, Wikipedia, all the kind of explosion of knowledge and information that's come from the internet has been absolutely incredible. And so a lot of what we've seen so far in XR has been kind of in that CompuServe AOL model where everything's kind of in this walled garden. And so how do we break out of that walled garden? I think is actually one of the biggest turning points in the history of XR. Right now, we're kind of in this choice point as to whether or not we want to continue to feed into these walled garden paradigms that continue to kind of enrich these billionaire, trillionaire companies and trillionaire individuals, or do we want to break out and kind of go back to the spirit of what the early days of the web were, where there was this democratized information and being able to share your code and be able to read the code and be able to read it and hack it and modify it and change it and kind of learn from this information. And so there's a similar kind of spirit that I think that the Open Metaverse Browser Initiative is trying to catalyze. So WebXR and the development of WebXR was kind of working with the W3C standards forum. This is a little bit different in the sense that they're just kind of doing it, and it's not coming from the W3C. It's coming from this outside organization that wants to create these standards from the Kronos Group. And so there's always been this dialectic between what the Kronos Group is doing and what the W3C is doing. WebGL was one of the things that was under Kronos Group rather than underneath the auspices of the W3C. But now with WebGPU, there's ways that that control is being more in the hands of the W3C. And so the W3C has been mostly the standards organization that has been dictating what can and cannot happen within the browsers and what everyone are doing. Even with like WebXR, there hasn't been like consistent implementations between like Chrome and WebKit that are deployed out into the browser versions. I mean, you maybe see the most close versions between like what's happening with the Apple Vision Pro and Safari and what's happening with Chrome, but Chrome pushed us out like years and years and years before Safari did and Apple. And so to kind of escape out of like this incentive where Apple and Google kind of want you to use your apps, if you really want to like vitalize this open metaverse ecosystem, then they're kind of doing this approach where they're just going to like create their engine and compile it in and maybe distribute their own browser as an application that allows you to do these different types of experiences. So it's a bit of way of bypassing that existing inertia of trying to get these big, huge tech companies to do it. But maybe over time, we'll see some of these companies adopt some of these different standards. But I think because it's under the Kronos Group and because they're pushing this forward in a way that is trying to get industry momentum, then maybe if enough people start using it and find it useful, then it may be something that gets into more of like the default versions of some of these different browsers. But at least at this point, they're proposing these ideas and trying to live into the future of what the internet and World Wide Web used to be, and trying to like live into what that might look like in more of a spatial and 3D version. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Neil happened on Tuesday, June 16th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So, hey everyone, I'm Neil Trevitt. So my day job is at NVIDIA. I'm also the president of the Kronos Group, which is a standards organization, does things like, you may know us for standards such as OpenXR, WebGL, GLTF. And I'm also president of the Metaverse Standards Forum, which is hosting this new initiative.
Nice. Maybe you can give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working with all these standards.
So I've been working in standards for a long time. I've been president of the Kronos Group now for 25 years. I got the bug with OpenGL back in the day when SGI did the right thing for the industry and put 3D APIs in open standards. And I saw the power that a good open standard could bring to the industry for good, and just been hooked ever since.
Nice. Maybe give a bit more context for the Metaverse Standards Forum and what was the origins for that to come about?
Yeah, the Metaverse Standards Forum has been interesting. The most important thing about the forum is it's not another standards organization. It's a place for existing standards organizations to come and collaborate. Because when the metaverse became a thing a few years ago, it quickly became apparent that it was going to take a lot of standards from a lot of different standards organizations. You know, Kronos is one, but W3C, Open Geospatial Consortium, there's dozens and dozens, you know, wireless standards, all kinds of things need to come together. But there was nowhere that was a neutral territory for all these different STOs to come together and coordinate, find the gaps, and to also talk to industry and all the users. So that was why the forum was set up, to encourage interoperability to create the metaverse. So next question is, what's the metaverse? Well, I think it's an spatial evolution of the web, which we can talk about in more detail. And I think the initiative we're going to be talking about, the Open Metaverse Browser Initiative, has an element of open source. And so it's really exactly the kind of project that the forum was built to support. So it's kind of a fortunate confluence of events that the project found the forum and the forum found the project.
Yeah, and so if we go back to Snow Crash in the metaverse, I had an interview with Tim Sweeney a number of years ago, and he said, you know, Snow Crash was written before the internet really came about, and the World Wide Web especially. And so, you know, the kind of depictions that we have of the metaverse are very much a lot of people's conception is of this kind of more, I guess, the updated version of Ready Player One, the sort of gamified virtual reality world. And it's a lot of exploring and having social interactions. And as I've talked to you over the years, I get the sense that the metaverse has kind of expanded out to an expansion of the web, but also like definitions as far as like a digital twin that maybe some sort of enterprise company is making a replication of their warehouse to do some sort of like digital and physical digital twin integrations. And that's not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind when people think of the metaverse. Right. But I'm curious to hear a little bit more around how you start to explain what you think are the key parts of what the metaverse is, especially in the context of Meta had changed their name to Meta because of the metaverse, but there is this popular conception that, okay, well, the metaverse is kind of dead for that vision of what they were doing with it. And so there's a lot of like baggage around that term over the last number of years. So I'm just curious to hear how you start to like really flesh out, like how you start to think about what the metaverse might be through the lens of these open standards.
Yeah. And I think everyone's perception of the metaverse is evolving, but you're absolutely right. You know, that the metaverse has been through some very negative PR cycles. I always have a kind of a bet with myself when I'm meeting someone new and they say, what do you do? I'm working with a metaverse. It's 50-50 whether they're going to burst out laughing or not. That's okay. But I think that recent history, and credit to Meta, you know, they put the metaverse on the map again, you know, a few years ago. But when that all happened, I think we took a fairly significant misstep in how we positioned and how we understood what the metaverse might be. I call it, and again, Matthew Ball's book, it's awesome, really, really awesome. But its central vision was based around VR, virtual reality. And virtual reality is awesome too. I'm not against virtual reality. But we're talking about a phenomenon here that could be global, replacing mobile phones. You know, this is something that needs to engage everyone in the world all day, every day. I don't think VR is that. VR has its place, but this isn't it. So the vision, and it's still out there you know, if you go to the European project funding, they still talk about the metaverse being a series of connected virtual worlds. You know, so this hasn't dissipated yet. But the concept of we're all going to exacerbate the social media problems that we're all suffering from by isolating ourselves in VR for hours and hours a day, you know, isolated from our friends and family every day. That's a dystopian vision. And I think the world's collective experience over the last few years has led society, rightly, to reject that as a vision of the metaverse. And I haven't told you before, my mum called me up when we launched the Metaverse Standards Forum saying, why are you doing the metaverse? That stuff's terrible. I go, what? And my mum knows what the metaverse is. So smart glasses, though, I think are an opportunity to reclaim the term, reposition the term in a much healthier and I think much more productive way. Because of course, smart glasses, they don't isolate you, they bring you into the world. And if we can create spatial services that really feed useful information and services into these devices, you know, we can encourage people to interact with the real world in a more productive and happy way. And that's a much more positive. So my definition of the metaverse is you're doing spatial computing on your smart glasses assisted with AI. And if you connect a whole bunch of folks together doing that, that is a good definition of the metaverse.
Okay. And so I know that the Metaverse Standards Forum has a number of different, I guess, affiliate standards organizations. Maybe you could just kind of lay out some of what you see as some of the key building blocks of the metaverse that have been standardized, and that we can get into the new stuff that was just announced yesterday and today. But I just want to get a bit of a sense of how you start to think about the existing standards as they are coming together. And like we said before you started recording this interview, that it's like these puzzle pieces that keep coming in, building out a mosaic of what this is actually developing to be. So just curious if you could set a baseline in terms of what other types of standards are out there that you can see as key foundational building blocks for the metaverse.
Yeah. So obviously the first one is the web for a number of reasons. You know, we want this to be a pervasive platform that's available to anyone, you know, in the world who wants to tap into it. And the web is the only platform that has that reach. It's pretty much the only platform with that reach. It is based 100% on open standards. And that means there's no one company can pull the plug for whatever reason, can't do a flash, both users and the developer community, and is already being used by everyone. The only thing we need to do is to extend the web to truly enable spatial services. And that's the new stuff that we can talk about. But that web and all the surrounding infrastructure that's needed, I think you can begin to put it into different buckets. So, and the standards organizations that are involved in evolving it. So, of course, the web stack itself is primarily controlled by the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C. There's also another consortium called WG that's quite heavily involved. Down at the bottom of the stack, where that web stack needs to actually talk to hardware, whether it's a GPU for rendering your 3D graphics or talking to your XR device, or importing 3D assets into your 3D API. That's where Kronos plays. We're at the bottom of the stack, you know, connecting software to silicon. That's our tagline. And you know, those standards will continue to be used. But then there are all kinds of services. There's all the wireless connectivity. You know, we don't plug our phones into the internet. It's all wireless. Wi-Fi, which is IEEE. There's 3GPP that does, you know, 5G, 6G, all of those standards. As we make the web spatial and we start using the web as we navigate and interact with the real world, you know, geolocation becomes increasingly important. And there's the Open Geospatial Consortium that has been working on that for 40 years. And then all of the ancillary issues become more important because they're going to be amplified. So privacy, you know, identity, as you wander, you know, from service to service, you wander down the corridor and you connect to another service, you know, that service needs to know who you are for real. And you're not going to have time to type in your age in your smart glasses. It needs to be automated, trusted. So security, privacy, and you just build out into all of these different types of services. You just come across more and more kind of standards and interoperability that's needed to make it all work together as a coherent platform.
So we also have OpenXR, WebXR, WebGPU, and there's also the GLTF. I don't know if you want to bring those into the conversation as well in terms of being a part of the spatial aspects.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you mentioned a couple of good examples where we've had good examples of like two standards organizations having a point-to-point liaison, we call it. And a good example is the Kronos Group and the World Wide Web Consortium, W3C. So, you know, the web stack, it has the native stuff at the bottom. Then it currently has the JavaScript stuff in the middle. And you know, WebGL builds on the native APIs. And actually, it's a Kronos standard. But WebGL gets built into all the standards and activities W3C do. OpenXR maybe is a better example. OpenXR is a native API from the Kronos group. But WebXR is a JavaScript API that leverages OpenXR, reaches down into OpenXR, but it's a W3C standard. So the W3C and Kronos, you know, work very closely together. Same thing happened with Vulkan down at the GPU native level, and WebGPU builds on top of APIs like Vulkan and Metal and DirectX. Vulkan is the one open standard that it's based on. So that kind of liaison and cooperation is good. It's an exponential thing. If you have two standards organizations, you can kind of handle it. Once you have 20 organizations and they're all doing different pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, you can't, you know, having 20 liaisons and all the communication gets very complicated very fast. That's why we needed the forum, Metaverse Standards Forum, to have everyone round one table to talk about how all this is going to hang together.
And I was just talking to Ben Irwin yesterday, and he was mentioning how GLTF, the latest version, is going to have streaming, which he was really excited about. And I don't know if you want to talk a bit about like what that's going to do.
Yeah. And actually, that's another great example of two standards organizations, you know, working together point to point, Kronos Group and the Open Geospatial Consortium. So about 10 years ago, the Open Geospatial Consortium said, we need to have a new modern 3D format for holding big geospatial data sets, and then they can be terabytes in size, and we need to be able to stream it, and we need to be able to stream it down to any client device, including the web. And what the Open Geospatial Consortium did said, well, let's not reinvent everything from the ground up. Let's find a standard that is close to what we want and then expand it to meet specific geospatial needs. And that standard that they chose was a Kronos standard, the GLTF standard. It was already widely adopted, but this was like another vertical that it got adopted into. And over the last 10 years, the Open Geospatial Consortium have done a great job in their standard is called 3D Tiles. 3D Tiles is basically just a set of GLTF extensions that the Open Geospatial Consortium have defined. And they've done a fantastic job in saying, okay, if you have a terabyte 3D landscape, how do you divide it up? Volume hierarchy, subdivision. Which bits do I need right now? So you can very efficiently choose the bits that you want to process right now, so you don't have to download the whole, you know, terabyte data set. And that's shipping in production. It's been used for years. And now we find that there are many other market segments that want to do that. People are going, oh, I'd like to stream a terabyte data set too. So we have a good relationship between Kronos and Open Geospatial Consortium. So Kronos doesn't have to reinvent the wheel now. We can go to the OGC and say, would you like to cooperate? And we can build the 3D tiles functionality back into core GLTF, the standard from the Kronos group. So it becomes more widely known and disseminated and used throughout the industry. And Open Geospatial Consortium, absolutely, because it's in their interest too. You know, the technology that they rely on, it becomes more robust if it becomes more widely available and more tooling gets built for it, you know, more applications using it. It's good for everyone. So we actually now have a kind of this virtuous circle where the Open Geospatial Consortium, using baseline GLTF, they don't have to invent everything like Gaussian splats. That was done at Kronos Group and the Geospatial Consortium. Oh, great. You don't have to do that. That's fantastic. We're picking up the 3D tile stuff, and this will be an upward spiral that will keep going. So GLTF 2.1, which is going to ship, we hope, this year, has a lot of the 3D tiles functionality. The volume hierarchies, which is the foundation for doing all kinds of 3D streaming, progressive streaming strategies. And also another important one, structured metadata. So you can begin to put a lot of metadata down to the individual 3D mesh or Gaussian splat level. And that is going to be the foundation for expanding GLTF. GLTF right now is a format for displaying 3D. Now you can download a GLTF and put it on your website. Also scanning Gaussian splats. Now we have Gaussian splats in GLTF. People are capturing everything in Gaussian splats. You can do that in GLTF. So it's a display format. It's a capture format. The metadata is going to make it a trainable format for world models. And once world models are trained using GLTF datasets, you know, continually refining the metadata within a GLTF scene, because Gaussian splats are differentiable, so the AI can experiment and see what fits the real world better and keep going around that self-training loop over and over again. That can use now GLTF as well. And once you have a trained scene, you can actually take that bucket of GLTF with all of the structured metadata and encapsulate the scene understanding that you've generated through your training, you know, your AI model training process, and say, here, you don't need to learn about that room or that building. I've done it for you already. You know, here's multiple levels of semantics, you know, identity. Here's a door. And the affordance, what can a door do? Well, the door can open if you pull it on the handle this direction and the hinges on the right. And then actionability, you know, what do I need to do? Do I need a pass key to get through it? You know, all this kind of metadata can be encapsulated and transported in a GLTF file. So it's quite a significant scope of work expansion for GLTF as we move into the AI era and the world becomes machine readable.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Ben was really excited about it. And it sounds like there's going to open up lots of different people who are going to have a variety of different uses and perhaps some that we haven't even thought about yet. So it's really exciting to see.
Just started. Yeah. And it's happening so fast, right? Because this year at AWE, World Models is the buzz. I think, you may correct me, but I think if we were here last year and you'd said to the typical person here, what's a world model? They go, I have no idea. And so this whole thing has kind of come onto the scene and is beginning to evolve into space of just a few months. It's really incredible how fast things are moving.
Yeah, no, Fei-Fei Li has been talking about it for a long time, and also that people who are looking at the limitations of large language models know that it needs more sophisticated cognitive architectures beyond just autoregressive large language models that actually have more sophisticated ways of understanding. So I think it's a part of like the next evolution that for folks that are following closely outside of the XR industry, maybe people closer to the AI industry, maybe had that tip of people who are critics of the limitations of large language models for a long time.
Yes. I mean, actually, you know, it's an ongoing debate because you talk to some people in the XR space and you say, well, you know, having structured metadata in GLTF and other formats, you know, this is going to be really essential because you need to make it tangible, right? And some people will go, well, you don't need that. You know, you just ask AI, it'll tell you whether you can go through the door or not. You don't need to do it. But if you're going to have physical embodied robots and vehicles making decisions on the real world, you know, you can't just talk to a latent trained vector. It's can hallucinate, all kinds of bad things go wrong. And you don't want to have to force your smart glasses to get trained on a new environment. You need to say, here's the environment, and then just give it the ground truth on what environment the user's walking into instantly, you know, not going through the training loop. So, you know, there's definitely a place for this, I think.
Yeah, the way I say it is that a lot of times AI does better when there's empirical feedback loops where it's able to be tested in some sort of way. And I feel like that the world models are going to be able to help do that. So Well, let's maybe move on to what's happening now with the next iteration of this standards that are being announced in terms of a spatialization of the browser with Sneeze, with RP1. And so maybe you just give a bit more context for how this came about and then also what problems were presented and what this is starting to solve.
Yeah. So, you know, all of us here at AWE, we're sitting in the XR industry. And I think it's apparent to many that the content ecosystem hasn't really taken off. I mean, there are many awesome walled gardens, you know, in that you mentioned the gaming space, Roblox, you know, is obviously awesome, but it's not an open platform. And, you know, there's Snap here doing awesome work with both the hardware and the software, but that's not truly an open platform either. And I think you can identify that if we had a truly open platform that can complement all of these other different business models, that is truly open to everyone, it will enable the whole world to start creating spatial content for any device that wants to be compatible with this platform. And this platform, as we said, is the web. The web is such the obvious candidate. So you look around, and this is a phrase that Sean Mann from RP1 uses all the time. We're in the AOL phase of the XR ecosystem, content ecosystem, because the first instinct on many of the hardware vendor companies is to have a curated walled garden, and they try to keep the content on their own devices. And the content creation community have been now burnt many times by putting a lot of investment in proprietary stacks and hardware of various shapes and sizes, and it evaporating overnight for various reasons. It's not a surprise to me that the content is not appearing. So if we can find a way to bring true spatial processing to the web, I think we'll open the floodgates for all the latent demand there is for good spatial services, and the latent demand in the creator community to actually have somewhere to create and ship safely with wide market reach. But no one's really had a clear vision on how do we break out of our AOL era into the World Wide Web era, you know. And I was kind of talking to my AI buddy about how bad was it back in AOL era. Did you know that, I guess I knew this, but I'd forgotten, if you were an AOL user, you could not email a CompuServe user. The two email systems weren't compatible. They were walled gardens around email. That's how bad it was. And then, of course, SMTP comes, an open standard comes, and those walled gardens suddenly become a huge disadvantage, not a potential advantage. And so they disappear overnight, and everyone now can send an email, you know, using SMTP to anyone. The same thing is about to happen, I truly believe, in the XR space. And RP1, I say they have a vision, and they had four good ideas to kind of make all the pieces fit together on how we can truly bring spatial processing into the web. And credit to them, they have been working on this for a number of years. And the announcement that we made here at the show was the work that they've done on a prototype spatial browser. They've now put into open source. And that's an open source project that's been hosted at the Metaverse Standards Forum, because it's the perfect project for the forum to host. And so this week at AWE, you know, we're trying to get the word out, saying, you know, this project has started. We think it'll have lots of advantages and benefits to everyone in the industry. You know, so come and join. Either join the open source project, and you don't need to be a member of the forum, you know, get in and just do the normal open source stuff. Or if you want to be involved in kind of the backroom discussions, and how are we going to solve identity? How are we going to have standards for avatars? You know, the working groups in the forum are informing the open source project and being informed by it, because the open source project is a great testbed. You know, we can actually try stuff out tangibly and say, no, GLTF is doing avatars, but, you know, it didn't scale to 10,000 users on a shard. You know, we need to do more to make it more efficient, whatever. The problems are that we're going to find, you know, it's a great testbed and proving ground for the interoperability that we need.
You said there were four good ideas that RP1 had. Can you go through what are those four good ideas?
So before I go to the four good ideas, the good question is, what's broken with the current web? Okay, that's absolutely the right question to ask, because if only we could find a way to do it with the current web stack, then we could all save ourselves a lot of work and we could just get on with it.
Yeah, I think that's what people were hoping what WebXR was going to do, but yet for a variety of reasons, there's a number of different limitations from that 2D paradigm without really fully going 3D spatial.
Yes. And I want to say WebXR is awesome and it's not going away. And there are many use cases where WebXR will be great and people continue to use it. This isn't an attack on WebXR. We're just trying to complement the existing web stack and take it to the next level up. And actually, I think a lot of the WebXR implementations might be able to use this new stuff too. So it's not an either or, but that's important because WebXR is an open standard and it's been created by a lot of folks that have put a lot of expertise into it. And it's a good solution, but it's kind of the old web way of doing spatial. It's not the forward-looking AI-powered way of doing spatial. So we talked to companies, and I think the beachhead, the commercial beachhead for this stuff is going to be the enterprises, because smart glasses are cool, but they're still a little bit too expensive for my mom. Too expensive for my mom. So in the next few years, it's going to be enterprises. There's a big pent-up demand in the enterprise space to ship these spatial services, hospitals, universities, airports, you name it, warehouses. They need two things. First of all, they need to have control of their own data, just like they do today on the web. A warehouse vendor or an airport, they can host their website. They don't need anyone's permission. They have total control on how and where they host and where their data flows to. They don't have to expose their data to any third party. We can't do that spatially. The only way to do spatial right now is WebXR. But WebXR, it can't discover new services. It can't composite multiple services into a single scene. Well, it kind of could. You could imagine a WebXR app with the cooperation of the people providing data. It grabs data from various places and creates a 3D scene. But it's not a general purpose solution. It's the app that's doing that composition. And that means someone's written that app. And that means all these people that are supplying the data, they're exposing their data to whoever wrote the app. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we need the browser natively to be able to identify services and information that have a spatial element and can be spatially composed, and for the browser to do it with isolation between all of the origin points for all of these services. Now, they can cooperate, but that has to be a buy-in, opt-in. So that's probably the most fundamental issue why no one's doing this spatially in the web right now. The other one is more aesthetic, but I think it's really important from an adoption point of view. Is the beautiful power of the 2D web is you don't have to figure out a program to draw text glyphs and your runtime loop to keep it. What happens when you scroll? You don't have to worry about all of that. The browser and the engine, the 2D engine in the browser, is a declarative engine. You say, this is my page of HTML, go render it. Everything downstream from that declaration of what I want on the screen happens in the browser. And that's a wonderful simplification for content creators. WebXR is not that. So WebXR, as you know, it exposes a bunch of wonderful functionality to JavaScript. You basically get all the input controls. It's all the OpenXR inputs being routed up through into JavaScript. And you get a display surface, which goes back out down through OpenXR, if you have an XR device. Everything else is up to the application developer. The runtime loop, how am I going to compose everything in a scene? How do I render it? What happens if it goes too slow? What happens if I have other data? How does that get composed in? It's all written by the application developer. So it's imperative. It's not declarative. And we need a declarative model for spatial web, just like we have it for the 2D web. It's the web way. Not only is it easier for the content developers, it lets you compose multiple origins into a single scene, and it's all happening in the browser, so it can all be private. The security is actually better than the current web for 2D. And say, well, why is it important to have all these multiple things? What's the thing about the spatial that makes multiple services suddenly so important? I think it's, you know, it's an arcane reason. If you have a 2D display, if you have 20 services, they're all going to overlap each other. If you are wearing smart glasses and you're in the middle of a 3D infosphere, you know, you can have services that are spatially positioned and very often are overlaid down to the pixel level, you know, true augmentations over the physical world. There's room and space to have the bigger context in a 3D spatial browser than there is in a 2D web page.
Yeah, and so as I talked to Sean, so they have Sneeze, which is a something you would add into existing browsers like Blink and then WebKit, basically to the web browsers that they're compiling it in. Yeah. He also mentioned that there's an identity aspect, and so they're able to have identity that's solved, and then also I'm just trying to trace down the four things that you have and how you start to identify what those four things are.
Yes. So to start us on the journey to the four things, the key realization is we're talking about the spatial web, but we're really talking about the spatial web engine. And that's really important because, of course, a modern browser like Chrome, you know, it's probably tens or not hundreds of thousands of man years have been put in, you know, to reinvent all of that would be crazy. So, but the good news is that's not what we're trying to do. So all the modern browsers, all of the rendering, the 2D rendering in today's browsers is done in an engine. And you mentioned Blink, which is, you know, the Chrome one, WebKit is the Safari one from Apple. That's the engine that takes the declarative, you know, this is the page I want, go away and do it. Thus goes away and does it. So all we have to do, and we're going to continue to need that, that's not going to go away. We just need to add another browser engine that truly understands spatial computing, and it can coexist along with the 2D engine. And of course, that's a much, much more constrained task. So that's what the open source project, the Open Metaverse Browser Initiative. It's not the whole browser. It's just the engine. That's what's being put into open source. So that's the first idea. We actually have a new engine, not the whole browser, to do this. The second good idea is how do you have the spatial composition in the native engine? And it's a simple idea. I mean, all four ideas are actually simple, which actually makes them more powerful, in my view, is that we're going to have a single scene graph and the browser can load in multiple services. It can provide access to the single scene graph to any of the services. Now, you might lock out, may have security, so each service only accesses their part of the scene graph. You know, that's kind of the default. But it is all one scene graph. And, you know, a scene graph is a well-known structure in gaming. Any 3D application has a scene graph. It's just a description of where all the meshes are spatially. And that was another really foundational thing, because the current 2D engines, they have something similar, but it's 2D and it's called the document object model, the DOM. So as you render 2D stuff, it goes into the DOM. The DOM is like so fundamentally 2D. So we need a 3D version. This is shared scene graph. It's the SOM, the scene object model. So that is the second good idea, is that you can download WASM modules, because WASM can be firmly sandboxed. WASM can come from any service. And you say, WASM service, this is your portion of the scene graph. Declaratively put in the scene graph what you would like rendered, and poof, it will happen, you know, in the native engine. We'll take care of everything below your declarative explanation of what you want to be rendered. So that's idea number two. So then the next idea is, okay, so I have somewhere in the native browser engine. Now I have a WASM service, can do anything it wants. But how do I discover and connect it to the 3D equivalent of web pages? So that is idea number three, which is a really good idea. And I think it has application way beyond spatial. This is the way REST should have been designed. It's the simple idea is that you have a service sitting on a server somewhere, as well as running the code that's on the server. It provides the code, in this case, the WASM code, that runs on the client. So the server and the client can do whatever communication they want. They can send whatever data they want, whether it's spatial or not. They can use whatever web protocols they want, doesn't matter, whatever they want to do. And it's such a simplification, because if the service upgrades, it just updates the client code too. REST, you have a REST service and you have 10,000 clients. You force 10,000 software developers to interface to your REST API that sits on the server. That's 10,000 times more work than you need, because you can just write it once and get it downloaded. So you save a lot of work and you get this enormous flexibility. And this protocol is called the RMAP protocol, Remote Model Access Protocol. And it took me like 6 months. Why is it called the Remote Model Access Protocol? And the reason is, the way it works is the client application who's using a service sitting on the server never touches the network. What the RMAP protocol does, it basically creates a digital twin of whatever state is in the service. It creates a local digital twin on client, and then everything else is hidden from the application. And again, it's one application developer writing both ends of that communication. So suddenly you don't have to worry about real-time programming, because all of the real-time stuff, you know, is in the RMAP protocol. The only thing that the client knows is I always have an up-to-date view, a digital twin of what my service is providing me. That's all I need to do. It's such a tremendous simplification. So that's idea number three. And then the last piece of the puzzle is, wow, these services sound so fantastic. How do I find them and how do I connect to them? And this is particularly important for smart glasses, because people are not going to be typing in URLs, you know, typing in Amazon.com. They're going to be walking down a corridor in an airport, and they're going to be connecting. They want to connect to all the local geolocated services around them. So that's the final idea, is what is the spatial equivalent of a website? RP1 have termed it a spatial fabric, which is kind of a cool name. And it kind of makes sense, because a spatial fabric is very simple. Again, it's a simple idea. It's, first of all, it can be pinned to a location if you want. It doesn't have to be, but most would be. Certainly kind of the ones you discover as you wander will be pinned to a particular location. So might, you know, for this conference center, for example, we'll have a spatial fabric. And then internally, it's a map saying, okay, the lobby's over here and the conference rooms are over here, da 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 da. And then a list of services at each location. And that's it. That's it. And the way you discover services, now, if I'm coming to a conference like AWE, I would choose to load the conference spatial fabric, which will be here. And then the coffee queue length and, you know, how full are all the meeting rooms, all these spatial services, I would discover just by walking up close to them. I'll have options. I can say, no, don't bombard me if I don't want it. Because I'll be connected to a spatial fabric. The spatial fabric will be being fed from the native browser saying, this is where I am right now. This is where I am right now. This is where I am right now. And the spatial fabric will go, oh, you're close to this new service. No, load that service in. And you've walked away from the other one. So unload that one. And then the services will be connected. And then my last question was, it took me 18 months to figure all this out. And then the last piece, well, how can you possibly use a service that you've never seen before? How can the client know what to download and out? The way these services are constructed, they have a well-structured introduction class model with reflection. So you can say, are you a service for the spatial web? And they go, yes, good. What do you do? Okay, so what information can you provide? And then you just go down the discovery tree and you can discover more and more about the service without having pre-read any documentation about it. So, and then the last piece is most people would probably want like a global spatial fabric. You know, so as I'm traveling to new places, you know, I go to Laguna Beach or something, you know, my AI agent will say, oh, no, you're on vacation now. You know, you're taking a weekend off after AWE. So you want to know where the good restaurants are. And that's my AI preferences. It knows me and it'll start feeding in those spatial fabric. But it's like the DNS server for the spatial web is a spatial fabric that covers California or US or the world, whatever. And that can be multiple vendors, just like they're multiple DNS vendors. You know, multiple people will have, Google will probably have one, you know, a global spatial fabric with all of the local services. And then you get to the conference center, you can attach to the conference center because some nested spatial fabrics. So you can discover, you can always discover what's around you with this very simple data structure. You don't need a global directory of services because that would be a real pain to maintain. You don't need it. You can just go local and the nested hierarchy of spatial fabrics will take you to the services that are active right now.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely incredible, all these things coming together. I'm glad to see that it's happening. And I guess a couple of questions, concerns that come up is like Keiichi Matsuda's hyper-reality vision of this kind of walking around the street and everything is just basically being bombarded by ads. And so it feels like, yeah, you might join in some services, but how do you prevent people from spamming you for, you know, seeing all the ads everywhere? But also, is there a sense that if you own a certain property, do you have control over what is and is not there? And then there's a free speech question around, can you basically have the freedom of speech to be able to overlay this kind of like metaverse hyperspace graffiti on any space that you want in a way that allows people the freedom of speech, but also there may be things that you don't want to see. So how do you have agency and control over these different types of things?
It's a really interesting question, but I think, you know, because through the OMBI, people keep asking that good question. And so we've been forced to think about it. There are a number of things. I mean, it's going to be complicated, but there are a number of, I think, simplifying realizations. One is any service is going to be opt-in, right? So I think we all remember, I can't remember, they served such a call out, you probably know. Now that it was like 10 years ago, there was a video, the dystopian future for AR.
Yeah, it was a hyper reality by Keiichi Matsuda. That's the one, yeah.
That's the one, right. Yeah, and so many ads, yeah, it's like, oh my God, let's not do that. So any service is opt-in. So that's the first thing. But you're going to want to opt into some. And it's going to be, you know, there's going to be thousands of spatial services around, I think. So it's going to get quite complicated to which ones you want, which ones do you trust, you know, which ones are relevant to your current situation. Are you on business or vacation? You know, are you with your family or not? You know, perfect use for an AI agent. You know, there's going to be thousands of enable buttons, too many to do through voice or gestures, but train your AI agent on what you want, and you say, you'll be able to say, no, find me the nearest Indian restaurant, and it'll go beep, 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 and it'll turn on the thing. Or you can just be more general. I'm on vacation, you know, tell me if there's a good festival going on, whatever it is. You know, the AI agent is, it will learn you, right? That's what AI agents are good for, and it'll control your options. So I think that's, you know, we'll learn how to use that over time, I think. You mentioned that there is an important foundation, I think. We do need to be able to trust a spatial service and know that it is the official service from the piece of land that we're currently standing on. Like if I'm wandering through an airport, going through Heathrow, I want to know that the routing to gate 27 is the official Heathrow routing, not some scam thing that says you have to pay $20 to go through gate 27 and whatever. And I think there's some regulatory backup we need there. It's kind of like a link between the land registry and having some kind of certificate of authenticity for spatial services. If I own a piece of land, my own house, for example, or, you know, a conference center like this, or the, you know, LAX, I need to know, I want to tell my AI agent, no, go to the official LAX service, because I need, you know, I don't want to be scammed. And that's going to take some kind of regulation or legal, you know, some, the land registry, you know, all the parcels, you know, everyone knows who owns every parcel in the world, basically. We just need to have one more bit of metadata in that land registry saying, you know, who's the official service provider for that parcel, something like that. But if you have those two things, I think everything else is manageable.
Yeah, Mark Pesce, one of the co-creators of the VRML, I had an interview with him at CES in 2017 where he was talking about his version of this problem. Like, he's had like a solution to that that he had proposed, but also had conversations over the years where there's sort of like a free speech argument where people could basically overlay anything they want over any piece of land, because there is this, you know, basically you don't want it. People who own land are the only people who can like have that speech there.
Well, I think that's why the registry official, I'm the owner and I can prove it, and here's my service. It solves that, because there's no way you're going to stop overlays. Now, how are you going to stop it? There's no way of stopping it. But you don't need to. As long as you know you're getting to the owner's service, and then it's up to you which other overlays you turn on. And you know, the scammy ones will get turned off pretty fast, and the high-value ones will get turned on. It doesn't matter if they're overlaying.
Yeah, and just a comment on the AI. I do think that having contextually aware AI has all sorts of privacy like implications, in a way that I don't know if I'd want an AI being able to monitor all that about my life, because it has lots of implications in terms of like collapsing all the contextual integrity of the flows of information that are appropriate for the AI to know or not know. So I would love to see if there's like a non-AI solution to that as well, because I don't want to have to like rely upon an AI if I don't want that personal AI tracking all these things.
Yeah. That's not a very complicated model though. It can be run locally. You don't have to run it in the cloud. You know, that might be a good local, you know, have your preference engine. That becomes a standard hardware feature.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see. TBD. I'll be having a Socratic debate against AI at the end of the week with share some of those thoughts. So, but yeah, just wanted to air that sort of concern around like not necessarily, because there are, I think the sentiment around AI is that there's also other people that have a little bit more of a, let's say, backlash against some of it. So one of the things I want to say in terms of this open part is that there's sort of the history of the internet going back to like 1989 was like the beginning of AOL and CompuServe. And so then, you know, 9 years later, we have 1999. That's like, so you had 89, you have the Game Boy, 99, you have the BlackBerry, which is sort of coming up. And so you're starting to dissolve the boundaries between work and home. And then the seeds of the internet planted in 89 and coming into full bloom with the iOS and Android in 2007. And so in that era, so that is like the beginning of the app walled gardens that we have right now with computing. But then the next sort of stop in 2014 to 17 is sort of like all of the XR devices that are a bit of the antidote to the portals of escape and addiction over smartphones. They're starting to say, okay, here's an embodied solution, but it's still kind of like the very early developments that we've had over the past decade. And now we have this point where over that entirety of the life of the internet, you have basically like 8 big tech companies that represent the most value, including NVIDIA now is at the top, but you have a little bit of this choice point as to whether or not we're going to have a handful of trillionaire individuals or companies controlling our digital futures, or having these open source models in a way that the sovereignty is kind of handed back to the individuals in a way that allows them, enables them to have a little bit more control over their digital futures. And I feel like that this open metaverse browser is one of those pieces that feels like it's a trajectory that's a choice point that we can make in terms of like, do we want everything to be proprietary walled gardens, or do we want things to have the way it was back in the very early days of the internet, to have this kind of like emancipatory and liberation for open source that's going to fuel things? And so I really feel like most of the things that are coming out, aside from maybe the Steam frame that's on Arch Linux that is built with a GPL license operating system, but other than that, most of the stuff that we see are these proprietary models, and that it is that kind of AOL era that we've been in. And I'm hoping at least that this type of thing is going to be this, the value of the network is basically exponentially increases with the number of users. And so the more opportunities for that, then it's basically going to move towards this more open model that is going to basically replicate what the World Wide Web and the internet was able to kind of have this flowering of this democratization of access, I guess. So yeah, I feel like this open metaverse browser is kind of going towards this kind of path.
I hope so too. And I think, you know, it's a reasonable starting point because down at the nuts and bolts level, because you don't need to share data across origins, which is lots of the 2D web has to do that. And it's basically broken, you know, security model. We don't have that. So that's perhaps necessary, certainly not sufficient, but you know, it's a reasonable start. But I hope so too, because it is a once in a generation opportunity. I think it is a kind of a transformational seismic shift as the web goes from something on your desktop to something you engage with in the real world. You know, it's a real shift. And I hope that society is older and wiser, having gone through the first, or you know, how many generations it is, but you know, where we are right now, I think we've all learned on the much more about the potential downsides. And so, yeah, I share your hope that we don't squander this opportunity.
Awesome. And finally, what do you see as part of the ultimate potential, or when you think about your intention for why you work on these open standards, like what do you want to see created and what do you think might be possible once all these things are in place? So thinking about where you think this is going in terms of the ultimate potential with integrating and embracing these types of open standards.
Well, I mean, at the kind of ecosystem level, I think open standards and working hand in hand with open source, it's a way for people to work together. You know, at its core, that's what it is. It's admitting that, you know, no one should be asked to do everything, that we can share the load. And if we are thoughtful in how we design open standards and the platforms that they enable, we can design it for the good of society. I mean, it sounds like highfalutin, but no, I think it's true. I think the web at its core has been an awesome thing for humanity. I mean, it's, you need to be careful, like any technology, you have to be careful how you use it. But at its core, enabling that level of communication, you know, I think is a good thing. And we really do need to be thoughtful about this new generation because, as you know better than I, the potential dangers, the level of information, that the intimacy of the information that's going to be gatherable and usable with these new generation of spatial devices is like many orders of magnitude more than we're currently suffering from. So we really need to figure it out. And if we don't figure it out, no one's going to use it. I think it's the bottom line. But at a personal level, you know, the thing that makes it all worthwhile is, like, I was doing a thing on Zoom the other day and someone said, in the middle of the conversation, someone said, Neil, I want to stop just for a moment because I want to thank you personally because my entire business is built around GLTF. So, you know, thank you. I go, oh. You know, doing good in the world.
For sure. Yeah, awesome. And is there anything else that's unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
I would just like to give a shout out to RP1, really, you know, for the OMBI stuff. They're doing it the right way. They have cool technology, but everything we need to make an open platform, they're putting it out there in open source. You know, I think it's enlightened self-interest because they're trying to build the market for their cool technology. So, you know, power to them. But you know, everything to make it open, they've put it out there. And they're putting a lot of effort into it. And they've had these four good ideas. So, you know, shout out to Sean and Dean and the rest of the team there.
Awesome. Well, Neil, thanks so much for joining me today on the podcast. And it's always a pleasure to hear what's going on with all the standards. And I feel like that, you know, like you said, the standards bring people together. And, you know, are we going to have a handful of the oligarchs and, you know, tech billionaires and trillionaires now controlling everything in our future? Or do we have people coming together and collaborating and working towards these visions of cooperation and openness? And yeah, it's really inspiring to see that. And I was really coming to AWE searching for stories like this to give me a little bit of hope for everything, where things are going, you know, in terms of just having a vision of the future where we have a lot more autonomy and sovereignty and control, but also the freedom to be able to do all these amazing things. So yeah, thanks so much for all the work that you're doing and, you know, laying down the groundwork despite all of the, I guess, skepticism that we've seen over the bad PR cycles around the metaverse. I feel like that the core of the metaverse of whatever it ends up being is going to be built on these concepts and these ideas and these standards. And we'll see from there, once all those little building blocks are in place, then we'll be able to see what is able to flourish. But it feels like a lot of really important seeds are being planted right now. So thank you.
It's fun. So truly, so, you know, invite everyone to come and get involved. No, it's cool.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.